with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
From KUT and KUTX Studios.
University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
We'll release our State of Black America report, and it's titled State of Emergency. We are in an emergency. The big ugly bill will devastate our communities. The cutbacks on civil rights will devastate our communities. The attack on democracy and the rule of law are something we've not seen in modern American history. We need a call to arms, if you will, a call to push back and fight back against what we're saying. And that's what the National Urban League Conference is all about, a call to arms, a call to action.
Mark Moyer, president and CEO of the National Urban League, the nation's largest historic civil rights and urban advocacy organization. Founded in 1910 and headquartered in New York City, the Urban League collaborates at the national and local levels with community leaders, policymakers, and corporate partners to elevate the standards of living for African Americans and other historically underserved groups. With 92 affiliates serving 300 communities in 37 states and the District of Columbia, the Urban League spearheads the development of social programs and firm public policy research and advocate for policies and services that close the equality gap. This past summer, for the first time, the organization held its annual conference in Cleveland, Ohio. The conference brought together a new generation of leaders that is rising to defend the gains made and to push for progress still to come. I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, the National Urban League Conference and the State of Black America Report with Mark Moriel, President and CEO in Black America.
The National Urban League presidency calls you. You don't call for it.
Mm-hmm.
And to a great extent, I was invited to interview for the job by the search committee. And I guess the rest is history. But it was an opportunity. I was two terms as mayor, term limited. And in effect, at 44 years of age, I had basically spent two terms as mayor. I had spent about a term in the Louisiana State Senate. I was at a glass ceiling in my political career in Louisiana. And when I was invited to interview, I thought of Vernon Jordan and I thought of Whitney Young.
At the opening session of this year's National Urban League Conference held in Cleveland, Ohio, President and CEO Mark Moriel delivered a powerful warning and a resounding call to action. Unveiling the 2025 State of Black America report, he declared the nation in a state of emergency, citing mounting threats to decades of racial progress and civil rights, democracy, and economic equity. The report, an annual flagship publication of the organization, outlined urgent threats to racial justice and democracy across a range of sectors, including economics, employment, education, health, housing, criminal justice, and civic participation. The report highlights efforts to roll back federal protections that have historically safeguarded the rights of marginalized communities. Also, Moriel put on the troubling employment trends. According to him, for the first time in a long time, African Americans' unemployment is rising while white unemployment is falling, highlighting a record number of African-American women entering the ranks of the unemployed. Recently, In Black America spoke with Moriel regarding the report and the conference.
It was my father and mother were both involved in civil rights, politics, and civic affairs, and they were no-nonsense parents. They emphasized education, going to church, doing chores, and participating. And also, by the time we were 13 or 14, we all had jobs, summer jobs. We had to work. There was zero tolerance for laziness, zero tolerance in the home that I grew up in. But it was also a place where purpose and commitment to community dominated the conversation. My mother was a school teacher. She was a civic activist involved in many, many projects and things. Of course, my father, a civil rights lawyer, legislator, judge, and then mayor of New Orleans. So I would call it normal in many ways, but special in a lot of ways.
Why the University of Pennsylvania didn't stay south for your higher education?
You know, my parents were very, very insistent that they went to HBCUs, mm-hmm. they went to segregated schools. They were very insistent on us going to schools that they couldn't go to. And my mother set a North Star when we were little. She said, the best schools in the country are Ivy League schools. That's where I want you to go. And she, as a second grade teacher, pushed that. And it's a big reason why I ended up at the University of Pennsylvania, because she really pushed my sister and our three brothers, and one brother and three sisters, rather, to pursue those schools and to leave town. They were very much believers in, you can stay here and go to Xavier, you can stay here and go to Dillard, you can stay here and go to Tulane, mm-hmm. but we want you to see beyond. We want you to experience beyond. My mother was highly influential in how we approached education, because she was an educator, and she wanted us to see, she wanted us to travel, she wanted us to experience things that we would not have experienced had we remained only in New Orleans.
Was it destined for you to become a politician 2 years in the Louisiana State Senate?
You know, my father never, ever pushed any of us to be in politics. In fact, sometimes he said, you all should not go into politics. You all should go and pursue business and pursue careers where you could make money. He said, politics requires a lot of sacrifices. Civil rights lawyering required a lot of sacrifices. But my brother and I particularly promptly ignored him. I think the sense of purpose created a calling, and that calling touched me in a very profound way, that my law degree, my education should be used for the betterment of the community, the betterment of Black people, the betterment of the cause of justice. And that is what sort of drew me in, and why my lifelong advocation has been in public service and politics and civil rights.
What did it mean to you following your dad's footsteps of being mayor of New Orleans for two terms?
You know, my father passed and never witnessed me being elected to any office. My career came after he passed on. I think it was something special, but I was very determined and focused on building my own name and building my own reputation, but certainly grateful for the learnings. Grateful for the fact that my father and mother left us with a good name that meant something in New Orleans and meant something nationally, that had credibility and represented something special and important when it came to public service and civil rights and fighting for people. And so it was, I think, always special when you get an opportunity in many respects to continue in the family business. But it creates double pressures, right? You're going to have those who are going to have very high expectations for you. You're going to have those who may think you're only there because of your family. And I will admit that as a young lawyer, a young politician, I did have a chip on my shoulder. I did believe I had something to prove. I did go the extra mile. I did put in the extra hours in an effort to demonstrate that this was something I had earned.
Now, you became president and CEO of the National Urban League, but I want to ask you that question. But before that, what are some of your most accomplishments as mayor of New Orleans? Because you have many.
I think we turned the city around. The city was in deep, deep trouble in the early 1990s. The oil bust had cost us jobs and people. The police department had become corrupt and ineffective, and we had a very wicked murder rate, almost 450 murders a year. So I think the most important accomplishment was making the city safer. And we did it by reforming the police department. We did it by investing in youth programs. We did it by rallying the community. I think we had great accomplishments in housing, great accomplishments in economic development and jobs. You know, we brought two Super Bowls to town. We brought professional basketball to town. We built a downtown arena, expanded the convention center. Brought the Essence Festival to New Orleans, created the Satchmo Festival as another significant music festival. All of these things, I think, we brought family amusement to New Orleans in the form of Jazzland. All of these things, I think, were the accomplishments of my time as mayor. And I always say they were the accomplishments, not of me, but of the team that worked with me in City Hall and the people at that time who were insistent and eager to rescue the city from the doldrums of the early 1990s.
22 years ago, you took on the presidency and CEO of the National Urban League. Why did you want to lead that organization?
You know, it was not the National Urban League presidency calls you. You don't call for it. And to a great extent, I was invited to interview for the job by the search committee. And I guess the rest is history. But it was an opportunity. I was two terms as mayor, term limited. And in effect, at 44 years of age, I had basically spent two terms as mayor. I had spent about a term in the Louisiana State Senate. I was at a glass ceiling in my political career in Louisiana. And when I was invited to interview, I thought of Vernon Jordan and I thought of Whitney Young. And I thought of the iconic role that the Urban League had played. So in that instance, how could you say no to an invitation to interview? The rest is history. And I've spent the last 20 years reforming, reviving, growing the National Urban League. I mean, we're five times larger than we were. We serve more people, 6.8 million in 2024 than in any year in our history. We're doing significant work in workforce development, job training, housing, small business development, health equity, after-school programs and youth programs. And we are an advocate for civil rights at the national level and for justice and for sanity in a time when we're fighting against the big ugly bill. We're fighting against cutbacks on civil rights, cutbacks on food stamps, cutbacks on workforce investments. So we lend all of this to being a voice.
You're listening to In Black America with Johnny O. Hanson, Jr. We'll be back in just a moment.
It's rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. Three times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with. From personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero. With takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
And now back to this episode of In Black America. Now we're a week out from the 2025 National Urban League Convention. Why is this particular convention so significant than others?
We'll release our State of Black America report, and it's titled State of Emergency. We are in an emergency. The big ugly bill will devastate our communities. The cutbacks on civil rights will devastate our communities. The attack on democracy and the rule of law are something we've not seen in modern American history. We need a call to arms, if you will, a call to push back and fight back against what we're saying. And that's what the National Urban League Conference is all about, a call to arms, a call to action.
Now, Cleveland has given us Dorothy Dandridge, Screaming Jay Hawkins, Langston Hughes, Toni Morrison, Jesse Owens, and Jim Brown. Cleveland also gave us the legendary Carl and Lewis Stokes. As many know, and some may not know, Cleveland has a proud history as a cradle of the abolitionist movement. In the 19th century, the Western Reserve, originally a part of the colony and later the state of Connecticut, was known as the most intensely anti-slavery section of the country. It was the Underground Railroad station Hope, the last stop on one of the main routes to freedom. And as we convene here today to confront a new and growing threat to democracy, civil rights, and equal opportunity, let Cleveland once again be known as Station Hope, a stop on the road to freedom. It's my privilege each year to open the National Urban League Conference with remarks that we call the State of the Urban League. This year, in addition, we are releasing the State of Black America report, which will be discussed in more detail at tomorrow morning's plenary. And we've added that report this year in an effort to give it broader readership and visibility. I want each of you to know, as the State of Black America report makes clear, we are in a state of emergency in this nation. The important gains that this nation has made in the last 70 years in civil rights, social and economic justice, yes, they are at risk. 70 years ago, 1954, on May 17th, nine courageous men, I might add all white, I might add all born in the 1800s, did something considered disruptive and historic. They decided that it was time to say that segregation violated the United States Constitution, and they struck it down as the law of the land. From that point forward, the hard work of generations of people, they litigated, they marched, they bled, they fought, they struggled, and they gave us an America in the second half of the 20th century, which was far different than the first half. It was America which was more open. It was an America which was trying to find the true meaning of the words, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all people are created equal. Those gains, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the War on Poverty, the Community Reinvestment Act, all of these are now under withering attack. And I'll talk to you about that in a moment, but before doing so, let me make another additional observation. 60 years ago, this week, a joint committee of the United States Senate and House were in deep negotiations on a significant piece of that civil rights history. The Voting Rights Act of 65 would be signed into law 3 weeks later on August 6th, 1965. The late Lyndon Johnson, great president for civil rights, said at the time that for 2.5 centuries, the history of our nation and the history of Black Americans were like two great rivers flowing along divided channels. It was only at Appomattox, he said, the decisive victory in the Civil War, when the two rivers, one shining with promise and the other dark stained with oppression, began to move towards one another. He called the Voting Rights Act a towering and certain mark that in this generation ensured that the promise of Appomattox would be kept. 60 years later, I'm not proud to report. In fact, I'm disgusted to report that not only has that promise not been kept, that those two great rivers are now moving further apart. One of the great points of divergence occurred 5 years ago when the COVID-19 pandemic, coronavirus pandemic, exposed the racial fault lines within our economy, our healthcare institutions, and our justice systems. However, we can be proud that at that moment, this Urban League movement pivoted to meet the challenge of those times. We sounded the alarm. In fact, we were one of the first to sound the alarm about the devastatingly disproportionate impact of the disease. Less able to access quality health care, highly likely to encounter systemic racism in the healthcare system, Black Americans were more than 3 times as likely to contract the virus and nearly twice as likely to die from it. Black communities bore the economic brunt of the pandemic as well, with Black-owned businesses closing at twice the rate of those owned by others. The National Urban League, we, our voice, the voice of our affiliates, we exposed this imbalance of the pandemic's economic toll. and the racial injustice in the beginning of the federal government's response. Into this powder keg of grief and economic despair, the murder of George Floyd felt like a lit match. 5 years ago, in the time of this intense crisis, the National Urban League and the Urban League movement embarked on one of the most significant and impactful advocacy and direct relief campaigns in our history. The Urban League fights for you. The Urban League embarked upon one of its largest commitments to equity in partnership with the Centers for Disease Control, and with more than 40 affiliates actively participating, we once again became first responders. What did you do, Urban League affiliates? We facilitated more than 120,000 COVID-19 and influenza vaccinations during the first year of this initiative. You hosted more than 850 events and clinics. We trained 15,000 community members as vaccine ambassadors. We established almost 5,000 vaccine sites. When others talked, we acted. When others intellectualized, we made a difference. When others stood on the side, we jumped into the fray. Urban League affiliates, I congratulate your incredible work during that very difficult time in American history, and you deserve another applause for that work. As protesters filled the streets to denounce racism and demand justice, the National Urban League acted once again. We created our Equitable Justice and Strategic Initiatives Division to advocate for a justice system rooted in fairness that protects and serves and restores all communities. EGSI, as we call the division, led the way as we push for the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. EGSI led the way as we developed a true action plan called 21 Pillars for redefining public safety and restoring community trust. A framework for criminal justice advocacy, and carry that message to towns and cities in partnership with our affiliates across the nation. EGSI became our voice to enable our affiliates to weigh in on police and justice system reform by organizing advocacy days, meetings with elected officials, building coalitions and partnerships. EGSI led our historic Reclaim Your Vote civic engagement campaigns in 2020, 22, and 2024. I want all of you to know that in the last 5 years, the National Urban League acted in response to a great American crisis. Together, our civic engagement effort reach millions of people, registering, educating, and turning them out to vote. And now EGSI is leading our efforts in the criminal records expungement area to help more people restore their lives and rejoin the workforce. In the last 5 years, we did not stop there. We were among the driving forces behind President Biden's historic Lift Every Voice initiative. We were among the driving forces behind the selection of Kamala Harris and Ketanji Brown Jackson. We were among the driving forces in ensuring that record numbers of African Americans, African American women, will be appointed to the federal courts of appeal. Our advocacy helped pass the largest road and bridge building program in American history. And we ensured that municipal water systems and broadband would be included in that. That plan matched our Main Street Marshall Plan. And we were the first to call for such an initiative. Joe Biden and his team heard us and, in a form of great respect, copied our plan and built it into law. Urban Leaguers, it was your plan.
Now, when you talk about the urgency, give us some examples that you are going to discuss during this gathering.
Well, I think we'll discuss, for example, how the Department of Justice has been reformulated
under the Biden administration with Kristen Clark of the Civil Rights Division leading that division, there were significant strides made in prosecuting police officers, in conducting investigations of corrupt police departments. That has been completely reversed, with the current administration saying, we're not going to investigate even if there is wrongdoing. We're not going to prosecute even if there's evidence. So that's one thing we will explore in a significant way. I think we've got to explore and share with people the impact of the big, ugly bill. All of the cutbacks, wealth transfer to the wealthiest Americans, how it will affect neediest Americans, not just the very poor and the poor, but the working in the middle class and entire middle class are all going to be negatively impacted by this big, ugly bill. And that big, ugly bill is, in effect, the blueprint that they've created for the next generation of America. We've got to repeal this big, ugly bill. We've got to replace it with something much better.
How has digital censorship and misinformation undermined democracy?
Well, it undermines democracy in a very profound way. We had made some progress, if you will, in encouraging those social media companies to keep hate speech off of their platforms. Much of that progress has been reversed by those companies with the current administration. Digital communications is where it is today. And we have to make sure that the avenues and the methods and the assets of digital communications are available to everyone, especially those in our community.
Final question, Mr. Moyo. How has diversity, equity, and inclusion protect and advance democratic ideals?
So diversity, equity, and inclusion describes one's commitment to equal opportunity. Equal opportunity is the law of the land, as per the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Those who are attacking it are smearing it. They are creating false narratives and lies about what indeed it means. When you say you're for diversity, equity, inclusion, you're standing up for values that are essential to American democracy. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all are created equal. E pluribus unum, out of many, one. Equal justice under the law. That is what diversity, equity, and inclusion stands for.
And addendum to that, Mr. Moyo, how can individuals fight back even though it isn't an election year?
Well, I want to encourage people to follow the National Urban League and me on social media, at Nat Urban League and at Mark Morial, but also to go to NUL.org and sign up for our weekly newsletter called Remarks. That's a basic thing, so you have the best, the most accurate information on this fight. The second thing I will say is it's time to begin readying ourselves for the 26th election. That means we've got to register everyone in our family and all of our friends, and we've got to motivate people to not go to sleep and not fall for the okey-doke that elections do not matter. Elections do matter, and we need a massive voter turnout in the next election to send a message that the American people are standing against the assault on American democracy.
Mark Morial, President and CEO of the National Urban League. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at KUT.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm John L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
Thank you, John. And now we have a segment from the Karen Hunter Show.
The next pandemic, and you have to do the research.
I'm happy to have a detailed discussion with you. You're so wrong on your facts.
You're interrupting me. And, sir, you're a charlatan. That's what you are.
We're ready. We're prepared. Do not give in to fear. We are fearless. This is not the time to be afraid. This is a time to stand up and fight back. And to resist any temptation for them to divide us. We're in this together. The rule of law is on our side. We will not give in, not give up. We will not capitulate. We will not bow. We will not bend. We will survive.
How art thou? How is everyone? Whoever's birthday? I know today's Beyonce's birthday. Happy birthday, everybody. Just listen. We got to celebrate these moments and these times we are in. Because I don't know how much longer we got after watching. I actually watched the Senate hearing today, the Senate, Finance Committee hearing with Robert Kennedy Jr. It was an S-H-I-T show. It was embarrassing, not for him, because the dead worm ghost that's in his brain has deluded him into believing that he's saying right things and he looks like an idiot. But that man is the head, the Secretary of Health and Human Services. He is presiding over all health for the United States of America. And I also think he's an avatar for the level of incompetence that we have leading every single department in this country. It is stunning how stupid this man is. And I'm sitting there like, I could be Secretary of Health and Human Services, except I have enough good sense to know I didn't do well in the sciences. I didn't. I mean, I didn't fail, but I didn't do well enough to sit there and have this man knows nothing. And he's in charge. He's in charge. And here's the other sad thing, but we're going to talk about it today. And I have a bunch of clips that I'm going to play. They ain't a damn thing to do about it because this motherfreaker is already confirmed. So this is just all performative. This is all senators getting their stuff off for donors or whatever. And including the one that voted to confirm him, sitting up there, Dr. Bill Cassidy. You had a chance to say no. You had a chance to say no, but you didn't stand up for the people. You stood up for your pockets. Enough of this. But I'm having this conversation because some of you out there also listening to the dead worm ghost of RFK's head with this vaccine nonsense. We have been vaccinated since I can remember. We eradicated polio and the measles and smallpox and all of the other things that children had to suffer from with the iron lungs and the short legs and everything and death. We eradicated it and it's back. Because people are stupid and they want to go to YouTube University and Reddit for their information and listen to people like RFK and Joe Rogan and some stupid ass on YouTube. And here's the thing as it relates to COVID, and I'm glad the COVID thing, because I lived through COVID. And I'm saying that facetiously because so did you. I got vaccinated. Guess what? Billions of people across the world got vaccinated. And most of us are not walking around, you know, with a problem from the vaccine that was, you know, new. And let me say, I was late because I was keeping my ass in the house. I was like, all right, I could avoid people forever. I'm built for this, being in the house. I got enough food, water, and all the other things and entertainment. I'm good. And then I was talking, I remember having this conversation as if it were yesterday. And on these airways, we were on Zoom. Everybody, we had figured out. I was like, this is beautiful. I could do everything from here. And I would have doctors on every single week. I had every kind of doctor, including naturopaths, including holistic health professionals like Dr. Sunyata Amin. And we were having all kind of conversations. And I remember having Christy Purnell on a lot, who was in the Moderna trial, Dr. Christy Purnell. And a couple of others, and having these off-mic conversations, on-mic conversations, talking with Dr. Hervé and Dr. Nana Yao, even at Healthy Wealthy Wives. We had a whole panel talking about COVID, and nobody got COVID and it was in the midst of COVID. I had a retreat in Pennsylvania in the midst of COVID. We all wore masks, and nobody left there sick. Nobody came there sick. Nobody got sick. And I was proud of that. And I remember having a conversation with Christy Purnell because I didn't want to take the vaccine. I didn't want to. Not for any other reason but side effects. I don't know. I don't know what could happen. I don't take an aspirin, y'all need to know this, for headaches. Fortunately, I don't get many of them. But when I do, I'm like, something's wrong. Maybe I'm dehydrated. Like, I'm going through my symptoms list. Okay, maybe I need more water. What happened today? Too much computer. I'm going to get to the root of it. I'm not going to take an aspirin to numb and dull the pain when there's a problem that I need to address. So I don't take aspirin for a headache. So I definitely didn't want to take not one, not two, not three, not four. I went through the whole thing. And I decided I landed on the Moderna one because that's the trial that Christy Purnell was in. Her dad had died from COVID. We gone through it. What's her name? Kizmekia McCormick, I think her name is. The doctor that was instrumental in this that they had been studying for years. So it wasn't new. It wasn't a new vaccine. But the truth is, all over the globe, people were vaccinated. So the fact that this man could say out his mouth that more people died from the vaccine than from COVID was stunning to me. And again, some of y'all are anti-vaxxing. You've been anti-vaxxed or on this anti-vax train, even though you were vaccinated to go to school, even though you got that little weird scar on your arm from, I don't even know which vaccine because I didn't scar. So I forget which one gives you that weird scar, the little circular weird scar. It looks like a butthole on your arm. Some of y'all walking around with that because you got vaccinated. Some of you couldn't go to college without getting vaccinated. And now all of a sudden we don't want to have vaccines in the whole state of Florida is now an option? With the world so stupid, we're more illiterate than we've ever been? People don't read. They don't know anything. But my feelings, I feel like I shouldn't get this. Oh, I saw a YouTube thing, and this is what we doing? And this man is in charge of all of the health thing. He takes dips in bacteria-laden water. He walks on airplanes with no shoes. Like, this is what we're doing? So I want to shout out the senators because for no other reason, the exposure of the idiocy was so clear. The exposure to sit and watch senator after senator undress this man, spank his, sent him on his way. It was beautiful. At the same time, I sat there and I said, this is not going to end well at all for any of us. This is terrible. So let's start with Bill Kennedy, Republican from Ohio, who could have voted against, Bill Cassidy, Dr. Bill Cassidy, Republican from Ohio, who could have voted against RFK, but didn't. You could have stopped this. So here's what he had to say today.
Mr. Secretary, do you agree with me that the president deserves a Nobel Prize for Operation Warp Speed?
Absolutely, Senator.
Let me ask you. But you just told Senator Bennett that the COVID vaccine killed more people than COVID.
Wait, that was a mistake. I did not say that.
Okay, then let me ask, because you also...
Senator, I just want to make clear, I did not say
that. We'll check the record. That's a question of fact.
Good say.
You also said that you were also, as lead attorney for the Children's Health Defense, you engaged in multiple lawsuits attempting to restrict access to the COVID vaccine. Again, it surprises me that you think so highly of Operation Warp Speed, when as an attorney, you attempted to restrict access.
Well, I'm happy to explain why.
I had 3 minutes and 30 seconds left.
I want to comment on his physical appearance, which does not look healthy. I don't want to comment on this congenital issue that he has, that his sister also has with his voice. I'm not going to comment on his voice and why he sounds the way he sounds. I'm going to comment on the sheer ignorance. Willful? I don't know. Is he doing this on purpose? I'm baffled. But again, Senator Cassidy, you could have stopped this. You're a doctor. You could have sounded the alarm. You noticed that something is wrong here. This man should not be in charge of anything, let alone the entire nation's health concerns. He should not be in charge. And he did make that claim. And he's been out. And what's ironic, your president got vaccinated. Your president got vaccinated. You know what's ironic? RFK, your children have been vaccinated. You've admitted that. Like, so what? What's the disconnect for the people out there who are still like, the people telling you not to get vaccinated are vaccinated and their children are vaccinated? What are we talking about, 255? We're talking about this the erosion of good common sense. Shout out to a Democrat I didn't know from Washington, Maria Cantwell. Maria Cantwell, Cantwell undress RFK Jr. She did that very well today. She called him a charlatan to his face. I love it. I love it. Again, it's performative. There's not going to be any good outcome from this. He's not stepping down. I would be shocked if he stepped. Who's stepping down? Why should he? Who can make him? The president? Oh, my God. All right. Play Maria Cantwell, please.
You're not following science, and that's what Senator Cassidy's question was. It's a simple yes or no answer. Do you think the president deserves to get a prize for warp speed in the mRNA technology that saved so many lives? And you won't answer that question.
I answered it.
No, you're saying that there are problems with what was interpreted. You could say yes. Do you say yes?
The president deserves a Nobel Prize, but our mRNA vaccines that we're working on, the ones that we canceled, which are for upper respiratory infections alone,
canceled $500 million of research because the mRNA technology is about continuing the research to be ready for the next flu, influenza, the next pandemic, and you have to do the research.
I'm happy to have a detailed discussion with you. You're so wrong on your facts.
You're interrupting me. And, sir, you're a charlatan. That's what you are. You're the ones who conflate chronic disease with the need for vaccines. The history on vaccines is very clear. This is the 20th century. That's how many people had vaccines and had illnesses. This is the 21st century. This is the decrease, 99% down to 100%. This is what was delivered with vaccines. And you don't want to support that. You don't want to support that evidence. So yes, the governors of the West, Washington, Oregon, and California will take up the efficacy of science. Yes, the University of Washington will deliver the science that America will depend on because you don't want to depend on it.
Yeah. The COVID vaccine during those early first couple of years before there was a vaccine because we were suffering and distancing and washing our groceries and doing a whole host of things before there was actually a way to keep people from being hospitalized, because that was really the thing. If once you were hospitalized with COVID, then it was intubation and then death was imminent. 18.5 million hospitalizations were prevented. These are facts. 18.5 million hospitalizations were prevented because of the vaccine. Didn't cure COVID, didn't stop COVID. It stopped the raging way in which it was ravaging, going through people's bodies and killing them. It stopped the most extreme way in which that virus presented in the body. It was never a cure. It was never going to be a cure. It also prevented 3.2 million deaths. Now, I'm sure everybody listening to my voice, you know somebody who died from COVID. I know several people who died from COVID. People are still dying from COVID. We're just not talking about it. People are still getting COVID and having very bad reactions to it. There are people walking around with long COVID. I've always said I never want to get COVID. I don't know what that's going to do to me. I feel more comfortable saying I don't want chicken pox, measles, mumps, or COVID. I rather deal with the side effects from a vaccine to not get those things. As somebody who just went to get the shingles vaccine, I'm mad about that. I'm mad that I got the chicken pox as an adult. Mad. Spent my whole life avoiding that. And family member came into my house and as a Trojan horse and dropped the disease in my house. But that said, you know, here we are. And good common sense, again, I'm not a medical scientist. I'm not a doctor. I'm going to trust my doctors. And yes, the pharmaceutical companies are definitely not to be trusted. I don't trust them either. Everybody's in it for some money, which Bernie Sanders pointed out.
We're ready. We're prepared. Do not give in to fear. We are fearless. This is not the time to be afraid. This is a time to stand up and fight back and to resist any temptation for them to divide us. We're in this together. The rule of law is on our side. We will not give in, not give up. We will not capitulate. We will not bow. We will not bend. We will survive.
It's a struggle to be a human being today. Who do you trust? Who can we rely on? I mean, every day we got to go outside. We got to breathe the air. We got to drink the water. We got to trust that when we turn on the faucet, we don't have lead in our pipes, and that the government that's in charge of making sure that's not the case won't do what they did in Flint, Michigan, which is change the water source and not tell anybody. Like we have in Baltimore, same thing. We have to trust, right? But then we also have to demand from the people who are in charge of the thing that they have integrity. And RFK has no integrity. Donald Trump has no integrity. And we're here. We're at the mercy of a government with no integrity. And so we're going to have to rely on the experts, people. And so who's an expert? They done drum poor Fauci into the ground. Man, like, I'm just trying to help people. And I'm not saying he's a perfect, because everybody's going to have some blemish. If you're looking through any life, it's going to have mistakes along the way. I'm certain of it. But what's the intent? Did Fauci want everybody to die? What was his gain in you know, trying to stand in the way of somebody telling you to take bleach and all this other stuff? Like, at some point, we're going to have an honest conversation with ourselves. Where do you get your information? How do you trust it? If you don't have a degree in science or what have you, or any medical background, who are you? Are you reading the medical reports? Are you out there actually doing the research? Or are you doing some quackery bull crap? I'm not saying Dr. Sabi's quackery, because I dabble in all of it, okay? Just going to be honest. Had several conversations with Dr. Sabi before he died. I'm down, okay? At the same time, you know, as Dr. Sunyata said, you know, the difference between poison and medicine is dosage. I mean, poison and cure is dosage, right? It's all from nature. All of it comes from plants. It's what they do to it, whether it cures or kills. And it's up to us human beings to try to stay as healthy as possible, keep our immune system as healthy as possible, be as strong as possible in the midst of everything that's going on. But this world is not kind right now to us. So we're going to have to be a little bit more discerning. And also watch our mouths with what we also promote, because everybody is across the board. Don't take the vaccine. Don't take any vaccine. Really? That's what we're doing. Are you OK? Oh, it causes autism. So everybody, 18 million people should have autism. Excuse me. 3 billion worldwide people that took the vaccine. We should all be autistic. Right. Because we're all vaccinated. Let me play. I know Kwame's ready to come in, but this was so infuriating. Bernie Sanders hit the whole, and this is a long clip, so leave my mic open, talking about the pharmaceutical industry, and he's talking about what I'm talking about right now, this trust thing. You have a Health and Human Services secretary out here spreading misinformation, and he knows it's wrong information. So what's his gain here? You know, because now you have a bunch of disciples following you, because don't nobody want to take the damn vaccine either. So they're willing to, if anything, the Bible talks about the itchy little ears. If it fulfills what your itchy little ears want to hear, you're good with it, even if it's going to kill the rest of us. Play a little Bernie Sanders, Ms.
So-called beautiful bill threw 15 million Americans off of healthcare, substantially raised premiums. And it's going to have a terrible impact on nursing homes, community health centers, rural hospitals all over America. Very briefly, is that really making America healthy again?
It's going to have it's going to be the biggest infusion of federal dollars into rural health care in American history.
Yeah, you know why? Because you're cutting $150 billion for rural hospitals. You're putting $50 billion back. It's not an infusion. That's a loss of $100 billion. All right, next question. President Trump, who I don't usually agree with, called COVID vaccines, quote, one of the greatest miracles in the history of modern day medicine that saved tens of millions of lives worldwide. Scientific community agrees with Trump. Lancet study found that it prevented almost 20 million deaths during their first year of use. Secretary Kennedy, are President Trump and the medical community right? Or do you still believe that the COVID vaccine was, quote, the deadliest vaccine ever made?
Oh, I, first of all, I didn't say that. Oh, I said that in terms of affairs reports a while ago. I said today, I think that President Trump should get the Nobel Prize.
So who's right? Is Trump in the medical community right, or are you right?
President Trump did an extraordinary piece of leadership.
Is he right or wrong? COVID saved millions of lives.
As I said, he got Americans back to work. At that time, that particular vaccine was perfectly matched to the virus that was circulating then. And I have no idea how many lives it saved, but it saved quite a few.
You know, what I find a little bit weird in this discussion, I'm hearing it over and over again this morning, Mr. Chairman, is we've got the entire medical community on one side. You got the AMA representing hundreds of thousands of doctors, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Public Health Association. All of these organizations are telling us that COVID vaccine and vaccines in general are safe and effective. You are casting doubt on that. Who are your scientific, who are the organizations that are agreeing with you and casting aspersions on vaccines?
The primary advisors are Marty McCary, Jay Bhattacharya, Dr. Oz.
Doctor. So you've got a few doctors with you, and I'm giving you the
few doctors. Oh, what you're talking about, if there's a big difference, Senator, between established science and the scientific establishment, which has been co-opted by the pharmaceutical.
So you're telling me, you're telling the American people that the American Medical Association, representing hundreds of thousands of people, have been co-opted and that they should not trust their doctors. And I'm the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American, and by the way, just for the record, every single Republican, I don't mean to be political here, Mr. Chairman, has received PAC money from the pharmaceutical industry. Are they all corrupt as well?
I'm telling you, the American Heart Association has been co-opted by the flu.
Everybody but you, Senator, but you know what? When you ran for president, you know, we have a corrupt campaign finance system. Maybe you'll agree with me or not. Okay, you were running for president, you had a billionaire behind it. You received $300,000 from people, not from the industry, people in it, as I did, from individuals. You corrupt. President Trump got $3 million. Every Republican got corporate PAC money for the pharmaceutical industry. Democrats as well. Everybody is corrupt, but you? Is that what we're looking at? I don't think so. And I think the issue
now, I don't even know what you're talking about.
Well, I think you do know what I'm talking about.
Yes, Bernie. Everybody's corrupt but you. Oh, okay. We're in some time. We're in a special time, y'all. It's going to require something of everyone listening. We're going to have to do more. We're going to have to read more. We're going to have to think more. We're going to have to question everything. We're going to have to critically think. And if we don't have that critical thinking muscle, we're going to have to develop it. Some times ahead are going to be really, really tough.
We're ready. We're prepared. Do not give in to fear. We are fearless. This is not the time to be afraid. This is a time to stand up and fight back and to resist any temptation for them to divide us. We're in this together. The rule of law is on our side. We will not give in, not give up. We will not capitulate. We will not bow. We will not bend. We will survive.
Oh, and oh yes, there was a discussion about Jeffrey Epstein.
Thank you so much. And first of all, let me just say that we are standing before you. We're having this conversation because of the oversight Democratic leadership. And so I want to reiterate that it's the Democratic leadership on oversight that has truly been able to move this forward. I'm sure many of you don't recall, but we were sent home early to try to avoid being able to take a vote on something like getting these files. We are about doing real transparency. We don't care who's in the files, we are going after you. So if I had to sum up what happened today, we heard the stories of victims, and honestly, we heard the story of at least one person that has never come forward before today. This was the very first time that she was telling anyone in a semi-public way her story. And if I had to summarize the theme, I would say that their theme was to do something. It is probably the theme of the American people in general right now when it comes to government, is that they want us to do something. So, yes, we had the roundtable, but they actually want to see some action. The fact that this started off in the 90s. And we had someone who could talk about what happened to them in the 90s. But then you go down the line and you've got somebody that's telling us their story from 2008. These failures led to years and years of abuse that did not have to take place. And so the reality is this. Some think that this is all over and some think that nothing else is going on. But if there was ever a RICO case, it would have been the Epstein case. So how we went from something that should have been RICO because of how sophisticated of a system this was, and this wasn't just one little sick old man that was doing stuff, but there were so many layers, whether we're talking about the banks that were involved, whether we're talking about those that worked for him, that helped him, whether we're talking about the monster known as Maxwell, and that's exactly how y'all need to refer to her. She is a monster. She is not a victim. So let me tell you, I want some action items to come out of this, because for once we somewhat look like we're bipartisan in the oversight committee. Number one, we need answers. We need answers on why it is that Maxwell was transferred from her current station in, or her former station in Florida, down to Texas. We need to have an understanding, because everything that I heard today leads me to know that for sure she was all up and in and through this entire process, not to mention that she was indicted by a jury of her peers, and then she was tried and convicted and given 20 years. So why is it that we had somebody, again, it almost seems like we are doomed to repeat our failures, because why is it we have high-level people that seemingly are running cover for a criminal? And that is what she is. She is a monster and she is a criminal. So number one, we need answers on what happened with that transfer, why it took place. And honestly, we all need to stand together and say that Maxwell needs to go back to where the monsters go, which is to a higher level of security. We also need to understand that Debbie Wasserman Schultz has legislation that she has been trying to push forward. And so in a bipartisan way, we all need to get behind Debbie, because we found and what we learned is that there were loopholes as it relates to the Crime Victims Act. And so we've got to make sure that no other victims suffer in the way that they did when you have somebody like Alex Acosta that decides that he wants to play games and dismiss a case and never inform the victims of what's going on as is required by law. So we are going to have to fix those loopholes to make sure that that doesn't happen, because it took them 10 years of fighting this. And ultimately, by the time they got to the end of it, well, it also was Jeffrey Epstein's end. And so there was not a resolution for that. And the final thing that I think that we need to do is, obviously, we need to continue to push forward and make sure that we get all the files, because we know that we have not received them all. Because I am standing in front of the press, I'm also going to make a plea. One of the things that I realized was that there's a lot of stuff that the DOJ may have, but honestly, if you don't have a thorough investigation, and I can't say if we had a thorough investigation or not, we have no idea. But the reality is that when you have investigators that go out and they collect information. I am not necessarily convinced that they even have gone out and done their due diligence to fully investigate this case in the first place. So if there's anyone in the public that believes that you have information that would be valuable, you've never been able to get through to federal agencies, or no one would listen to you when you try to go forward and bring information forward, I am asking that you trust oversight Dems and you bring that information to us. Or if you know where some information is contained, let us know so that we can then send subpoenas out that way. We want to do right not only by those that have already suffered under Epstein, but we want to prevent other trafficking rings that we know are out there. We want to make sure that we are doing right for future generations. So with that, I now have the honor of presenting to you the firecracker out of New Mexico.
That last story was from Forbes Breaking News. We want to thank you for listening, and we'll see you the next time. Take care.
My colleagues and I at NOW didn't play by the conventional rules of Beltway journalism. Those rules divide the world into Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, and allow journalists to pretend they have done their job if instead of reporting the truth behind the news, they merely give each side an opportunity to spin the news.
That's Bill Moyers, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Bill Moyers in defense of public broadcasting. The founding principles of public broadcasting urge that programming serve as a forum for debate and controversy and provide a voice for groups that may otherwise be unheard. Ever since its inception, public broadcasting in the United States has been a lightning rod for political attack. A heat shield funding proposal to insulate PBS and NPR from congressional whims was defeated. The Nixon administration was the first to launch the canard that the system was biased in favor of liberals. Note that the longest-running public affairs program on PBS was iconic conservative William F. Buckley's Firing Line. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, CPB, partially funds public TV and radio. In mid-July, Congress, by razor-thin margins, voted to eliminate previously approved funding for CPB. This action will negatively impact hundreds of public TV and radio stations. Staff will be laid off. Programs will be discontinued.
In Idaho, a teacher was recently forced to take down a poster in her classroom that said, "Everyone is welcome here." They said that was a divisive political statement. And you know what? From the fascist point of view, that is a divisive political